Okay. Welcome back. Okay, so this session is all about mindfulness in action. So this is our informal practice. This is really actually what it's all about. Really, the only reason we do the formal practice is to facilitate the informal practice. Because of course, you know, we might only be meditating for, you know, 10 minutes a day or something. So we don't want to just be kind of feeling nice and calm and relaxed for 10 minutes of every day, and then for the other 23 hours and 50 minutes feel stressed and tense and mindless and unconscious and all those other things, you know. It's completely pointless. So the reason we do our formal practice is to benefit the rest of our lives, the days that we have at work, in relationships with people, with family, with kids, whatever it may be. The reason we need to do a formal practice regularly is because it then reminds us. It's a recent reminder. We haven't, you know, if you're going to do a formal meditation mindfulness practice like every 3 weeks, then when something comes up, it's quite a long time for your mind to remember back to about how to deal with these kind of emotions or sensations or feelings or thoughts. Whereas if you've done a meditation every morning or every evening, it's not that far you've got to go back. It's not that far your mind's got to remember to say to yourself, ah, I know what to do when I'm feeling these sensations. I know what to do when I'm feeling these thoughts because I practiced that this morning. And so it's easier to kind of go back into that state rather than if you haven't done any meditation for ages, then it's easier just to go into your old conditioned habits. And it's really about training ourselves to respond instead of react. I think that's a good one. Respond instead of react. Respond being conscious, deliberate. React tending to be unconscious, undeliberate, based on conditioned habits, patterns, the reactions happening in the limbic part of the brain, the fear mechanisms. Respond is really about making conscious, deliberate decisions about how to respond to some stimuli, whatever that stimuli might be, whether that's your boss shouting at you or your kids screaming at you or whatever that stimuli might be. And the other reason that mindfulness is beneficial here is that through our mindfulness we practice understanding our own feelings and emotions. We actually feel those feelings and emotions, and we notice the variety of feelings and emotions that we have that we don't necessarily consciously try and create, and we practice acceptance of those. And that practice within ourselves leads us to have greater empathy for others. You know, we kind of know just kind of how mixed up and crazy emotions and thoughts can be stirred around inside ourselves. And therefore, we can be a bit more empathetic with someone else when obviously they're maybe reacting to their stirred up emotions or thoughts. We kind of, yeah, just have that bit more compassion for them maybe. And this is something we can incorporate into our day. So we'll start with mindfulness at work, in the workplace. And there's a guy called Mark Chaskelson, who's in the UK, who really specialises in mindfulness in the workplace. And I'm going to read out a couple of examples that he uses. This is from his book. I highly recommend it, called The Mindful Workplace: Developing Resilient Individuals and Resonant Organisations with Mindfulness Practice. So take the case of James. It's like story time, isn't it? Okay, gather around. Take the case of James, who is driving to an important meeting for which he's late. He's feeling tense, hassled, and not particularly mindful. A long line of cars has already built up as he approaches the traffic lights at a busy junction. Just as the line begins to close up at the red signal, another car races up from behind him squeezes past at the last moment and takes James' place in the queue. James is now precisely one car's length further back from the lights than he would have been had that car not pushed in. In fact, he's about 4.2 metres further back. An average speed of, say, 15 miles per hour, 40.2 metres per second, that means he'll be more or less one-tenth of a second later for his meeting. But it doesn't feel like that to James. In fact, in that moment, from his perspective, it feels like a complete disaster. Oh, God, now I'm really going to be late. People are so rude, so pushy. Gah. Shoulders tighten, his hands clenched on the wheel, and his mind begins to race. What a mess. How can I now be so late? They'll never take me seriously at the meeting. This is so unprofessional. I hate being late. What a pig pushing in front like that. His stomach starts to churn. He can feel heartburn coming on. His whole body starts to tighten up and he begins to sweat. What James is actually doing here is setting up the conditions for a not very successful meeting. He's going to be in pretty poor shape when he walks into that meeting room a few minutes late and precisely one-tenth of a second later than he would have been had that car not pushed in front. Had James been paying mindful attention to his experience, and had he even been a little mindful at any point in the unfolding scenario, then things could have been quite dramatically different. He might, for example, have become aware of the way he was gripping the steering wheel. He might have found, for instance, that it was almost painful and that the tension from him gripping actually spread up his arms and his shoulders. Bringing some mindful attention to that, he could have actually deliberately loosened his hands on the wheel. His actually shoulders might have then softened and his stomach might have begun to settle. Taking a few deep breaths, he might have thought, oh well, one car in front, that won't hurt too much. Now, how shall I best handle this? Shall I just apologise for being late or should I just carry on regardless? Or he might have become aware of how he was feeling. This is what I've talked about observing the feelings rather than becoming the feelings. Gosh, I'm angry. Or gosh, oh, there's a bit of anger arising in me. Wow, oh, my stomach's really started churning like a washing machine. Okay, let's just chill a bit. A few deep breaths, coming back to the breath. Or he might have become aware of his thoughts. Oh, here I go again. I'm catastrophizing. I'm a few minutes late and there are silly my mind, silly thoughts writing off the whole meeting. Okay, now come on, a few more breaths. How am I going to handle this meeting? What's my most effective opening? So with some training, James could have handled this little situation like that much more easily, actually just through that initial process of mindfulness, awareness. Awareness really being the starting point, awareness of our own patterns, our own habits, as they're constantly arising. They're constantly arising. There's constant stimuli throughout our whole lives, our whole day, triggering reactions, triggering stimulus and triggering a habitual pattern. So the first stage is really trying to bring that awareness to our day. We practice intensively in our formal practice. And then the whole day is like a beautiful opportunity to try and notice moments of awareness. And it might only start off as being moments. It takes time. But what you'll realize is through more and more practice, you'll bring more and more awareness into your day of how your body is responding to the stimuli out in the world. Who was someone else had an example? Who brought the example of the... You mentioned that earlier, didn't you? But, yeah. Mm. 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 It did. Mm. You can start. You start seeing it as an opportunity. It's like, yeah, great, that opportunity arose. I got to practice my mindfulness again. You kind of start seeing things which you would have previously visualized as being a pain in the butt as really great opportunities for yourself. Like you're fortunate. Ah, oh, that was a really fortunate opportunity to practice, you know, something about yourself, about your mindfulness. And it just completely reversed the way you see a lot of things, actually. Again, you know, I used to be terrible, like with the driving and stuff. Like when I was 18, 19, 20, I used to have terrible road rage. I obviously had a lot of anger at the time. I actually had some almost fights at the side of the road with people from road rage at that age, you know, from people cutting up and getting angry and swearing and fingers and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, as you said now, you know, I consciously, oh, someone pulls in, it's like, ah, oh, and I still can feel myself reacting. It's, you know, some of those triggers still happen, but it's noticing those triggers and it's a pretty powerful feeling to start to notice the fact you're noticing. You know, we're getting a bit, you know, you're noticing the noticing. Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. Yeah, empowered, yeah. Empowered over your own reactions and your own control. So that's particularly around awareness. There's another one. There's another one here. And this is, so the second thing. So awareness was the first definition of mindfulness. One of the next ones was being in the present moment. So the present moment. So imagine the case of Emily, walking from the train station to her office on a sunny spring morning. She's completely oblivious to the sensation of the first rays of early summer sun on her face. Nor does she catch the fresh fragrance of a shrub she passes that has just burst into flower. The sense of vitality, of well-being and of being alive that might have come from either of those experiences was lost to her. She missed them. Instead, she's fixated on a to-do list for the next week. Not that she needs to be, she could recite it off by heart. She's been over it again and again, ever since she woke up. But there she goes again, reciting the tasks once more. Now, Emily thinks of herself as conscientious, and she is. She's a good worker, focused on her job. But the way that she's needlessly and unproductively rehearsing her to-do list, checking its details for maybe the 100th time, actually keeps her from refreshing herself in simple ways during the day. So she'll arrive at work in good time and she'll get on with her tasks very efficiently. But her performance won't be quite as good as it perhaps would have been if she'd been refreshing herself a little bit more. If she'd been able to really use those opportunities to broaden her mental and emotional horizons. But more than that, preoccupied with her to-do list or with her attention wandering into the past or future, Emily isn't actually as present as she thinks she is in her day-to-day working life. Sometimes her attention wanders into the past. Oh, that meeting last week, if only I'd taken the chance to make that point. Oh, if only Will hadn't spoken in that way and maybe it would have been better. Oh, maybe if I'd worn those other shoes. Or it drifts into the future. Now, what will I make for dinner tonight? You know, what should we book for that holiday? Should we book it before the prices go up? You know, what will I wear tomorrow? And so on and so on. She thinks she's diligently getting on with the task, but actually a lot of the time is as if she's just put her mind into a kind of automatic pilot and just let it run on as it does. So I think, you know, look, we've all had that kind of you know, experience. We can all experience that kind of activity, and it's not that that's going to completely disappear, but it's about starting to almost catch ourselves. It's almost starting to bring awareness to those times where we might start dawdling off into the future or the past or getting lost and getting absorbed into something. So the third and the last story. So this is about letting yourself experience things without judgment. And another one of the key aspects. And this is the case of Laura. So this is all based in the UK. So Laura's based in London, office of a company, and she's been asked to present her team's findings to a group of senior people in New York by video link. She hates doing that. Standing alone in the video suite, facing an inert camera, being seen by a number of people whose names she barely knows 3,500 miles away. It makes her nervous, but Laura thinks she ought not to feel nervous. Oh, why am I feeling nervous? It's stupid. It's just a camera, after all. I've done these video link presentations before. God, I'm so stupid being nervous, she thinks. And what she's doing, she's adding an additional layer of harsh, critical judgment to herself onto what's already a difficult experience for her. So, of course, when the video link goes live, Laura's suddenly overcome with nerves. Her face flushes. And then she's trying to suppress the flushing. She freezes. She fluffs her opening lines. Struggling to catch up with herself, she stumbles again and again. At the end of what's quite a less than satisfactory video conference, she dashes for the loo and bursts into tears. I'm just rubbish, she tells herself. I can't do this job. I'm just no good. I'm just not up to it. None of this is actually true, of course. But Laura stays in a position and her confidence has been seriously undermined. So, if we look at how that could be done a little bit differently with some mindfulness training, Laura might have actually noticed that feeling of butterflies in the stomach and noticed, oh, I feel a bit of nerves arriving. I can feel my nerves being activated. So she might have actually acknowledged what was happening, acknowledged the tightness in her jaw, the tension in her shoulders, and actually started to explore those sensations with a bit of compassion and softness for herself. Okay, I'm feeling those nervous sensations. That's interesting. But I know through my practice that doesn't have to affect me. I don't have to react to those nervous sensations. I can just observe them without judgment. I can be with those. I can still just do the best I can. She might have been more conscious about planting her feet to the floor when she stood in front of the video link, being more accepting of what her performance was. And actually, with that deeper confidence that would have emerged, her performance actually would have been far superior. So there's a few examples in the workplace. Now, there's a few other more obvious things in the workplace that we can think about. How we can actually practically apply mindfulness. So I don't know if anyone else uses this. This is a new technology that's been around a little bit, but it's called email. Okay. So I think most of us have come across email by now. And it can play a pretty important part of our day-to-day lives. In fact, in a work environment, it can actually make up, you know, a huge proportion of the communication that you're undertaking during the day. There's a bit of a problem with email as a form of communication. It doesn't always communicate our intentions, our feelings, our emotions, our body language as effectively as we do when we're speaking to people face to face. And emails can actually often have undesired effects. So a really good place to start with mindfulness is really with your email sending, especially particularly important emails or emails that you might want to be convincing something or persuading something or selling a particular idea or concept, is to, for a start, just don't send the email straight away. It's the classic one, you know. You write your email and then you stop. You sit, you practice your mindfulness. You might even close your eyes, do some breathing. You don't even have to close your eyes. If you don't want people in the office to think you've, you know, dozed off or something, you can just do it with your eyes open, but you can just count your breaths, inhaling and exhaling. Just take a pause and then perhaps reread that email. Try and visualize the person at the other end. Try and visualize their day. Try and visualize their life. Try and visualize their workload. Try and visualize their emotions. Really try and empathize with the person who's going to be receiving that email. Imagining how it might be received, whether they would receive that as beneficial or not. You might then decide to reword it. You might even decide it's so important you're going to pick up the phone. You know, and often with really important things, it's actually just easier to pick up the phone or go and see someone. Once you send the email, it's very hard to get it back. You do get those retracted emails sometimes, don't you? I don't really see the point of that because you've read the first one. Then someone tries to retract it. It just sends, this email's been retracted, but it's still there, sitting there. It's way too late. You can't retract something that's been sent. So, calendars. So, it's an interesting practice if you've got a particular busy calendar full of lots of stuff in it, is to actually practice looking at your calendar and observing the sensations and the reactions that happen when you look at a calendar. Particularly if you look at a particularly blank calendar, that might create various sensations, especially if you're running your own business. Not so good. If you're working in an office environment, your calendar's likely to be jam-packed full of stuff. So just practice looking at it, feeling how you react, what reactions happen. Often you might notice some tension, you might notice some your heart rate increasing. Can you feel the stress response being triggered? That's the interesting thing. Do you think your stress response can be triggered just by looking at your calendar? You know, well, of course it can. You know, absolutely. This is what's happening. We're triggering our stress responses with things like looking at our workload. So just bringing some awareness to that is the most important step. Just bringing some awareness to, oh, God, every time I look at that calendar, I feel stressed and anxious and I can feel things pumping around my body. That's a really good, important starting point. But then, of course, there's practical stuff that you can do with regard to your calendars. You know, of course, you can look at your calendar. You can start to have the questions, you know, did I put everything in that calendar? Do I really need to be at all of those things? You know, am I working in a bit of a kind of cover-your-ass environment, a workplace, which, you know, a lot of workplaces are like that. You know, do I feel compelled to be at these meetings because if I'm present at these meetings, will that give me more chance of being promoted, more chance of being seen as a good worker? You know, are these some of these meetings a waste of time? So you can actually approach your calendar with a different view maybe. So not only observing the sensations that it triggers, but also being maybe slightly more vigilant about why you think you need to be at those meetings and how important they really are. Are other people from your team at those meetings? Do you really need to know everything? Could someone else do those things that you think maybe you have to be there to do? So the next one is generating ideas. So, you know, business speak loves to come up with, phrases around this, you know, thinking outside the box and lateral thinking and all these ideas we like. And it's really one of the fundamental things that businesses need to have is new, fresh ideas. Really coming up with new ideas that can be accepted. But often within business and work environments, it becomes stale. We create a culture of a particular pattern of thinking or a type of thinking which just feeds itself and it just reinforces itself. And often it can be very hard to actually come up with real new ideas in creative brainstorming sessions. So a lot of the same processes to brainstorming can be applied that we have in mindfulness. Firstly, you know, to try and clear your mind beforehand. So rather than just going into a brainstorming session, actually do some kind of meditation, some kind of mindfulness practice at the beginning, maybe with some breathing, maybe with some focusing on the mind, just trying to calm the mind, maybe some simple physical exercises, raising the arms, lowering the arms. And only then start to participate in the brainstorming process. And of course, with brainstorming, really important to practice the non-judgment. That's a really key. So when people are throwing out the ideas, it doesn't matter how wild or crazy or stupid or ridiculous or rude or anything. It doesn't matter. There's no rules when you're brainstorming. When you're brainstorming, you just let it flow. Whatever just comes out, you let it flow. You write it up. It's really important you don't judge it at that time. Analysis and response can happen at a later time, but just let it get those ideas out and then look at them afterwards. So another one is time management. So what they've shown through studies is basically even a lack of focus, the lack of ability to focus even for 10 minutes can actually mean about a 20 to 40% reduction in efficiency. That's the American Psychological Association who have done those tests. And look, anyone who works in front of a computer knows about this. You know, you're there, the emails are pinging, those blimmin' email things which tell you every time you got an email. They make sounds, the phones ring, people are coming to your desk. You know, you start on one thing and then you get distracted. You're on one web page and you click on another. We're living in an age where it's really easy to just completely go in different directions. So this can be a real problem with efficiency. So time management, you know, obviously with more and more things to do, we want to be efficient. Efficiency is an important thing to be able to do. So really what we're looking at instead of time management is really about prioritizing our attention rather than prioritizing our time. So we're really talking about attention management and actually deciding, okay, what are we going to give our attention to for this amount of time? And that does mean cutting yourself off from other things for a period of time, at least 10 or 15 minutes. So try and have some segments in your day where you're dedicated to focusing on your awareness on one particular topic or subject for at least 10 or 15 minutes. So we learn how to refocus our attention on what's really important, and we become more effective, less stressed, and actually seem to have more time by just putting the effort in to have that awareness focus. And then lastly, in the business one, meetings. Now, that's the one thing I really don't miss from corporate world. I used to remember sitting in meetings and just like, and just going into this like sense of sleepiness and just hearing people drone on, and there was like way too many people in the meeting, and you know, I didn't know what half of them were speaking about half the time. And so yeah, look, meetings can be a big part of business life. So a good strategy for meetings is to really set a clear intention before the meeting. So rather than just rush into the meeting, it only takes a second or two, really set an intention for what your objective for that meeting is. Both, not necessarily in terms of what you're going to achieve, but also in how you're going to behave, what your intention is for your behavioural patterns. That might be you want to practice being calm or non-reactive or focused or attentive. And then really practice mindful listening. So this is a really key one. There's lots of different ways to listen. You know, lots of people say they're listening, but of course, given we can't see what's going on in each other's minds, you know, often as they're listening, they're judging, they've got a commentary going on, they're trying to solve, they're critiquing, they're thinking about something else because the person's completely boring them. It would be a very different world if we could all read each other's minds. If there was like a little bubble and we could see exactly what someone was thinking as we were speaking to them. But we can't, but we can listen, we can focus completely on listening, and we can also be attentive to the person who's speaking to read the other signals. And those signals can be really important. You know, it's been talked about quite a lot about how the non-verbal signals can sometimes be more important than the verbal signals. And we read those signals through mindfulness practice, by observing, by awareness. We might notice the, you know, the look in someone's eye when we say a particular thing or talk about a particular subject. It might actually help us with negotiation in the business negotiation, because you might get insights into the other person you're negotiating with through their body language, which could actually be beneficial to you if you're trying to persuade them to buy your product or your idea or run your, you know, whatever it is. those insights that you can get from the body language can be quite important. You might notice them start to tense up or react. You might see the meeting going in a bad direction. And if you've got a slight foresight of that, then you can put things into place, more empathetic behaviours, to try and help the other person avoid tensing up or reacting as well. You can be more conscious of your own body language, aware of the signals that you're sending with your language, your own stress response. And you can do this by watching your breath as well. So you can be in a meeting, you can be speaking to someone, you can be having a dialogue whilst being aware of your own body and tension as well. You don't have to stop doing anything to be aware. You can be aware, particularly when the other person's maybe speaking. That's a good time. You can focus on your breath. That can help you be mindful of what the other person's saying. And also afterwards as well, you can have some self-reflection. Oh, how did that go? How did I react? Did I speak as I thought I was going to speak? What body signals did I send? It doesn't take long. It really doesn't take long. It could be, you know, just a few seconds here, a few seconds there, but just these little bits of, you know, blinks of mindfulness coming in to the day. So, the other one is really at home. And with the best mindfulness teachers in the world. Kids. Who's got kids? Who's got kids? So, yeah, kids are tough. Kids are challenging. I think, and this is just my kids, but I doubt it is from what I hear. Kids can really push your buttons. Kids can really know how to get you to react. Kids can easily trigger rage, anger, stress response, all of those different things. We try and control them. They, of course, don't do anything we say. So, John Kabat-Zinn actually has written a book about actually mindful parenting. And he basically tries to suggest that you need to try and view the 18 or so years that your kids are at home as a mindfulness retreat, 18 years of practice, basically. and just bring some consciousness to your own responses and your own reactions. So through he talks about three key topics, actually. He talks about sovereignty, empathy, and acceptance, the three topics with dealing with our kids. So sovereignty is really about recognizing that they are not really our children. They're not our anything. We don't own them. They're actually, even though they might only be 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or older, they're their own egos. They're their own identities. They're their own beings. They're their own sovereignty. And they're their own creatures. They're their own creatures to make their own mistakes, do their own learnings, as hard as that can sometimes be. And so a bit of that is actually just letting go a little bit of that need to control, but understanding that they are kind of sovereign beings as well. The second one, empathy, is through our mindfulness practice, through understanding our own emotions as adults and how hard it can sometimes be as reasonably well-developed adults to observe our sensations, to practice not reacting to sensations, emotions. You know, it's hard enough to do when you're 42 and you've been studying this for 8 years. You know, let alone when you're 3 or you're 4 and, you know, your older brother's just poked you in the eye or something, or your younger sister's just smashed your blocks up. It's hard. So the point is, you know, we've got to have that real empathy for the children when they're going into their rage, when they're going into those states where they're completely overpowered by their emotions. Have empathy for them as creatures that really haven't learned yet how to master their own reactions and emotions. And of course then paying mindful attention to what that does for us. When they go into a rage, how that triggers our sensations and our awareness. And again, actually, the awareness is everything. The awareness is everything. Almost by just having that awareness, it actually dissolves a lot of the impact. It dissolves a lot of the reactionary force. You can't mindlessly react if you're aware of what's going on in your body, because it's by definition, it's the opposite. So just taking that time, use the breath. The breath's always there. Like, you know, thank God we can consciously control the breath. You know, use the breath. Whenever you're in that situation, you've been doing your 10-minute practice in the morning. Ah, I've got my breath. Do some breathing. Oh, look at those sensations. And then respond. So it's the respond, not react. Respond, not react. So, in summary, for all of this, a kind of a general guide to really both formal and informal mindfulness and how we can use it in action. So, the point is we have to anchor our day with a formal practice. That's the first part. We have to anchor our day with a formal practice. Look, if you're enlightened, fine. You don't need to be on this retreat anyway. None of us, I don't think many of us are enlightened. You know, maybe one every billion people are enlightened or something. I don't know. Maybe not. But for the rest of us, it's just damn hard work. You know, it is hard work. And, you know, we can't expect to be perfect without actually putting a bit of effort in to try and improve our responses. You have to practice. And this is what that formal practice is. You have to anchor your day with some kind of formal practice. And we'll talk about this in the next session, about the personal practice. The second point is you've got to actively look for experiences to practice your informal mindfulness practice. So through your day, actively try and look for occasions where you can put this into practice. See it as a bit of a game. You know, oh, I wonder when the next occasion is going to arise today where I can put my mindfulness practice into action. So actively look for those things that trigger you. And as we said earlier, then they become actually beneficial. It's like, oh, great. My kid just poked me in the eye. Oh, thank you. That's a great practice for me to practice my mindfulness, my non-reaction. So look for those experiences to test your mindfulness. And actually actively look for those moments where you can actually practice that. And as well as that, linked in with that, actively look for times where you can focus on your breath. Little snippets during the day, a little bit here, a little bit there. You might be walking to a meeting. You might be starting your car is a good one. This is one I practice, actually. I found myself rushing when I was getting into my car, being in the car, got my seatbelt half on, the phone's there, I started, you know, it's all rushing. And I've got a new rule now. I have to take a few breaths before I start the car. I have to get in the car, I put my seatbelt on, I start the car, then I take a few breaths. Just 2 seconds breath. It's just a little tiny thing. And those, just adding in those little tiny moments during the day of just taking a few breaths can actually make a really big difference to how you go through your day. And fourthly, you can do a little bit of a review. And journaling's a key mindfulness technique, doing a bit of a journal, just noting down just a few little things. It's not really about having the record of it as much as going through the conscious process for a couple of minutes about how your day went, how your practice was went, starting to bring awareness to your practice. The great thing about this is you'll start to notice differences, you'll start to notice changes, you'll bring more awareness to the results that you achieve. And perhaps lastly, try and have some kind of practice before bed. Some kind of mindfulness practice or meditation practice or spiritual practice, or it might be a mindfulness book that you read a few pages of. You might do a little mindfulness meditation. You might, do a few mindfulness movements. Just something, just a little thing. It's good to kind of top and tail your day with this kind of practice. And it doesn't have to be long. It's just about introducing little snippets of mindfulness into your day. It can actually make all the difference. Okay, any questions about mindfulness in action? Yep, beautiful. Yep. Relaxation, CD, guided meditation. Yep, all of those things are great. Particularly if you suffer from insomnia. A lot of people, their minds are still racing. If they've had a really busy day at work, it's hard to get that out of their mind. So just some kind of practice can be good, some kind of guided practice, some kind of gentle movement practice, just something just to start to quieten the mind. Of course, the worst thing is to go from being highly stimulated, with the TV or, working on the computer, doing emails, and then try and go straight to bed. It's important to have some buffer, a bit of buffer between busyness and sleepness, just to bring the brain down a little bit into sleep mode. Brilliant. Yeah, of course. That's exactly what it is. It's just a form of mindfulness movement, linking the breath to the movement, flowing. And yeah, I think Tai Chi would be great. I think the more you study this, the more you look at all these different disciplines around the world and actually realize they're all doing the same thing. They've all got the same purposes, really. Right, okay. Yeah. And it's part of the compassion as well, and it's part of cultivating compassion for people who do things which might have previously made you angry, and then you start to try and practice compassion for people who do some of the worst things in the world. I always get into trouble for this because people don't always see where I'm coming from. But, I might be at a dinner party and I might be trying to understand terrorists who have just, blown people up, trying to put myself in their frame of mind. What are they going through? What's going through their mind? What experience are they having? How are they suffering? Really try and empathize with. Yeah. You can do that with all the different people. You can think of the most heinous crimes in the world, the things that outrage the people the most, and then practice trying to empathize with them. A lot of people react to that when you do that. They think you're trying to encourage them or saying it's right or wrong or it's a good practice to do, because often enough those people actually are suffering the most. That's really where it comes from. Those hideous acts come from suffering. They got a hard job, America. It's hard trying to be the world's policeman But things like, declaring the war on terror, of course, that just encourages it. A lot of the stuff has been self-encouraged. You're giving something for people to fight with. Then it's like, oh, we were wondering what cause to join. Now we'll join the cause against America. Now there's a war to be declared. They've got something to join and be part of.
Yeah.
Peace. Exactly. And that's the same as where we talked earlier, you know, about the unconscious bad habits. We're not trying to stop the bad habits. We're consciously practicing the good habits instead, yeah. Because otherwise you're just feeding that which you resist, persists. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yes, I think.
You were mentioning about before sending in response from the email
or yeah.
The accuracy thing. Take a break. Take a break reading, exercise some breathing. Is that, does it, do you mean to say that take a that short inhale and long exhale?
Sure, just any breath awareness technique, so whichever you might just notice the physical components of your breath, you know, the diaphragm contracting, the air being pulled in, the lungs expanding. You might notice the four parts of the breath, the inhale, the pause, the exhale and the pause. You might want to count, breathing in for two, three, four, out for two. Any technique or tool or method that brings awareness to the breath, yeah. Just bring awareness to the breath. Have the mind trying to focus on the breath. Yeah, just to clear the mind a little bit and sit with it. I've had stuff that I've sat with for days, actually. And then at the start of it, I thought it was dead set the right thing to do and send. And then 2 days later, I've completely ripped it up and not sent it at all. Just completely through mindful awareness and sat with things for a while, and actually realised that actually, no, that's not going to happen. So even, you know, sit with especially important things or controversial things or things where there's tension, you know, or issues around. It's the longer you sit with it, sometimes the better. Yeah. Sure. Oh, well, I'm not sure about happy. I'm not sure about the word happy, but yeah, content and peace of mind, yeah.
Going back to what you said yesterday about personal
Yeah.
So does that mean, well, if I look back at my life,
yeah,
I met many people who are, you know, without, I don't think they did practice.
Yeah.
Mind, yeah. Much better people.
Yeah. Thought, okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And there were others that were the exact
one. Yeah.
So this mean that in a person's DNA,
yeah,
you have a greater predilection to be one way or the other.
For sure.
The other way is try harder.
For sure. You've definitely, absolutely, that's exactly what it is. You've got a predisposition. You've got a greater tendency towards some patterns or the other. And of course, you know, your DNA is part of it. And then, of course, all of the nurturing that happens, you know, but perhaps even more importantly, you know, the nurturing that happens in the first, you know, 18 years or whatever can play a massive impact as well. And then your whole environment, of course. So it's a combination of all of those things. Of course, because they're different. Exactly, yeah, yeah, because it is, you know, genetic disposition as well, and we're all different, and we all react differently to different things. Just because they're brother and sister or twins or whatever, you know, I've got twin boys, and you know, they react completely differently. They've had the same environment, the same love, but they're just different creatures. We are all different creatures, and you're right, some of us have to work harder than others, definitely, absolutely, with some things. Some, you know, you might have to work very hard at practicing non-reaction, but actually you're very driven and driven to achieving in other areas. So it's often different, you know, people have different strengths in different areas, yeah.